Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case for this morning is Palka versus the City of Chicago.
Well, good morning. I've asked to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the Court, Stephen Plant, on behalf of the plaintiffs and appellants, Peter Palka and Ted Palka. There's two aspects to this case as it's consolidated. One deals with the issue of summary judgment on Peter's case in the 1983 case, and the second one deals with whether or not Peter and Ted can bring a Title VII action in light of what happened in the partial grant of summary judgment on the 1983 case. This is a case in which Mr. Peter Palka, who is of Polish ethnic origin, was brought into the office of the Deputy Superintendent Tobias. He was brought in ostensibly on discipline, but then Tobias asked him where he was born, where his parents were born, what language was spoken in the home, all of which has nothing to do with anything involving the man's work or his ability to perform as a recruit. He indicated that his father was from Poland and that he spoke Polish in the house, and then Mr. Tobias got angry with him and said that he looked terrible, they didn't need people like him, and then recommended his termination, which, of course, was accepted within a week. And it happened within a week of another situation almost identical to this one, involving Wojciech Czarnecki, another recruit who was also of Polish ethnic origin, whose parents were born in Poland, who speaks Polish in the home. The same litany of questions, essentially the same litany of questions, was asked. And he, too, was fired, both within a week of each other. So there was a national origin claim under Section 1983, and while the Title VII matter was pending, or the action of the IDHR matter was pending in Illinois. And the court below granted summary judgment against Mr. Palka on the on the 1983 case against the city, but denied it against the individual. And then the city moved to limit the damages because it was an individual in a 1983 case. The magistrate Nolan severely limited the type of damages that were available. So we non-suited the case because it became an untriable case. We then filed a Title VII claim after being able to obtain the right to sue letter from the EEOC, at which point the defendants moved to dismiss, claiming issue preclusion and res judicata. We have argued, as we've argued in the briefs, that a Title VII claim is very different than a 1983 case. We've given you the case precedent, the Buckholder case, among others. And essentially, from a logic standpoint, it would have made no sense to pass Title VII in 1964 if the Section 1983 claim, which dates to the Civil War, the post-Civil War era, Reconstruction era acts, if those acts were sufficient, then there would have been no need for Title VII. Plus, Title VII is different from a statutory standpoint because it involves an administrative agency. It requires you to go through an agency's investigation process and then to obtain a right to sue letter before you can file suit in federal court. And that's where the time period runs. It's 90 days from the right to sue letter. It's quite different than the 1983 case, which has a 2-year statute of limitations, and you can go into court immediately. So the issues are different. The claims are different. The damages are different.
Your opponents suggest that it would have been incumbent upon you, under our case law at least, to move to stay the 1983 action until you got your right to sue letter, so that they all could have been tried together, and that your failure to do so does make you liable to the imposition of the doctrine of res judicata in the Title VII action. What do you have to say about that?
Well, the record shows below that we had difficulty obtaining a right to sue letter. We got affidavits from the agency officials indicating that they don't just grant those right to sue letters. They do their own investigation. When there's a pending matter at the Illinois Department of Human Rights, it's automatically cross-filed under a work-sharing agreement with the EEOC. And they don't just grant you a right to sue letter. So you are not in control of being able to obtain a right to sue letter just because you want one. Therefore, to stay the action would be difficult because we would not be able to tell the court when we might be able to obtain a right to sue letter because there was an investigation going on at the Illinois Department of Human Rights, and then the EEOC has the right to review that at that point and then issue a right to sue letter if and when they choose to do so, despite your request. So, yes, in a perfect world, it would be nice to be able to ask for a stay But to ask for a stay when you have no idea when the EEOC might be issuing a right to sue letter doesn't seem to be a remedy at all, because you can't tell the court what to expect. And we obtained those affidavits, those declarations from the agency officials, made a part of the record, and that's one of the issues that comes to bear in a res judicata collateral estoppel issue, is whether or not you could have brought all the claims in the first instance. Obviously, we could not. Since we could not, then a stay was not possible.
Well, those are two different statements. It's not that the stay wasn't possible. You're saying you didn't feel that you could do it because...
We couldn't do it because we couldn't go to the court and ask... Well,
you don't, we go to there's the court no requirement when you ask for a stay that you be able to predict either the outcome or the timing of the disposition of the collateral administrative proceeding.
Your Honor, most district court judges, and I, you know, when you go in front of a district court judge under the Civil Justice Reform Act, they are under time pressure to move the cases. They're not going to sit back and let you stay a case for 2 or 3 years or stay it indefinitely. There's pressure on the judges and pressure on the litigants to get the case resolved.
Well, right, but you let the judge make that decision. You make the request, and then you've protected your record. That didn't happen here. So you're kind of bound
by the litigation
strategy that you adopted to non-suit the claims and then allow the merits judgment to enter on the claims against the city, which then has preclusive effect on the Title VII actions when they're later brought.
Your Honor, you're right that we did not make the request. That is correct. Perhaps we should have made the request. We didn't make the request because we didn't think it was realistic. We also did not believe at the time, as we don't believe still, that a 1983 action is preclusive to a Title VII action. And if the issues are different, the proofs are different, the damages are different, the scheme is different, then it doesn't require that because it's not the same litigation.
That's not really the test for preclusion, though. It's whether the claims arise out of the same core of operative facts, not that the claims have the same elements or the same measure of damages, et cetera. And there's no question that the Title VII claims arise out of the same core of operative facts as the 1983 claims.
Your Honor, in each of the cases, the one that's already been decided
by this court and then the one that's before us now.
Your Honor, I beg to differ with you. I agree with you in essence, but I disagree with you on the specifics. And the reason I disagree on the specifics is I cite you to the Torcaso case, which is the Illinois Supreme Court case, which applies the same evidence rule as opposed to the same transaction rule.
Why does that apply here?
Well, because that's, first of all, what you're doing is you're looking at the same transaction. You're saying the same core of operative facts. If the evidence required is different, then you look at the evidence that's used. If the evidence is different, then the cases are different. And that's, there's two separate tests for issue preclusion, and Illinois follows the same evidence rule, which is slightly different than the same transaction rule. The same evidence rule says that if the evidence needed to prove the case is different, then the cases are separate and different. They're not the same. And in fact,
we're here with two federal causes of action, are we not?
That's correct. They're both federal causes of actions, but not every federal cause of action precludes another federal cause of action.
Why would the Illinois law apply as opposed to the federal law?
Because if it's that goes back to Erie versus Tompkins and International Shoe, and the decisions that deal with if there's no substantive the substantive law issues are applied based on the court in the jurisdiction where the court's sitting. Since this is an Illinois case and this involved an Illinois transaction, then Illinois' rule would apply on the issue of res judicata. Because res judicata and collateral estoppel are state concepts. Basically, the courts apply the state law.
No, that principle applies only if we're reviewing the preclusive effect of a state court judgment. What we've got is federal court judgments here.
That's correct.
So we don't apply state preclusion doctrine, we apply our preclusion doctrine.
Well, because we
don't have an underlying state court judgment that's the subject of the preclusion defense.
It's, again, a question of procedural versus substantive rules. If it's a procedural rule, then it's federal. If it's substantive rule, then it's state.
Okay. I think you're
misreading. Let's take your argument. Let's go and take your argument.
That's a good idea.
Okay. I will refer to the court for purposes of this argument. Let's talk about whether or not these are the same transactions. Certainly, they're based on the same facts, but they're not the same causes of action. because you can have the same facts and have two separate causes of action and not have issue preclusion. And we cited you to the restatement of second, section 26, which gave the example of a lawsuit seeking specific performance based on a certain set of circumstances. And the restatement says, and it cites to, it cites to a specific case, Phillips versus May, I think is the case. And it says that if you have a situation in which somebody sues unsuccessfully or improperly for specific performance, that does not bar them from suing for money damages. And that's kind of the same situation we have here. When you have a Section 1983 case, especially since the city successfully argued it, with different damages, a different damage scheme, then you have a different set of circumstances. And even though it's the same nucleus of operative facts, they are different claims, and they have different remedies. And if the restatement applies, then it would apply here as well, because this is no different than a claim for a specific performance being the 1983 case versus a claim for money damage, which we would argue would be the Title VII case. So they can, there are circumstances where cases can arise under the same facts and not be precluded.
There wasn't a claim for monetary relief in connection with the 1983 case?
No, I'm arguing that by analogy. I'm just saying that if it applies, I'm not saying that obviously there was a claim for money damages.
Right.
But the money damage claim was severely limited. For example, Judge Nolan ruled that there was no front pay, which is an equitable remedy, so that under the what remained of the 1983 case, there was no equitable remedy available for reinstatement or front pay. There were no punitive damages, which are provided for under Title VII, and they're capped. There's a statutory scheme in terms of the damages for exemplary damages.
That's not really the right focus for a preclusion defense, though, because just by virtue of the fact that there are different remedial schemes doesn't make them the claims not arise out of the same set of facts or the same transactions. And this sort of claim splitting is what the preclusion rules are designed to inhibit.
Right, but as the
restatement
points out,
so if you've got multiple remedies, even if they're different, you have to bring them all in the same suit.
Well, but as the restatement points out, there is such a thing as claim splitting, and it depends on what the damages are. It depends on what the remedies are. If the remedies are different, the claims are different. If you have two separate statutes, and one has an administrative agency and a whole investigatory process and a statute of limitations that is based on a right to sue letter, which is 90 days, versus Section 1983, which is proven in an entirely different manner, doesn't have damages capped, doesn't provide for punitive damages, and in this case, the judge limited reinstatement and front pay, you have entirely different claims. They may arise out of the same facts, but the claims are different. And the issue involving claim preclusion is to prevent people from arguing the same thing a second time. If you have different remedies and a different statutory scheme, you're not arguing something the second time. You're arguing two entirely different matters. Yes, there's going to be circumstances, even in a claim preclusion situation, where there are going to be similar facts or the same facts. But that's not where the test ends. That's where the test begins. You start from that standpoint, and then you take it from there. Just because you answer yes at the first instance doesn't mean it's precluded in the second instance. Basically, what happened then is that the court just said that because of what happened with the 1983 case, the Title VII case couldn't proceed. Now, we've cited to the Buckhalter case, which involved a situation where the person tried the case. This was a situation where they tried the case under the Illinois Human Rights Act, and they lost. And they did not appeal it to the appellate court. They then turned around and filed a 1983 action and a Title VII action in federal court. That case went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court and then came back down again. And the U.S. Supreme Court said the 1983 case was barred, but the Title VII case was not. And basically they did the same kind of analysis we're trying to do here, and that is it discussed the differences between a 1983 claim and a Title VII claim and said that they're different. And that's controlling precedent in this circuit, certainly controlling precedent in the United States because it's a Supreme Court decision. And we feel that the Buckhalter case applies as well. That's a federal case that deals with the federal case law, and we feel it shows that we're allowed to bring the claim.
The underlying determination in that case was an administrative determination by the Illinois Human Rights Commission?
It was a trial.
But an adjudicatory proceeding in front of an administrative agency, not a court judgment.
In front of an administrative law judge with a trial, with evidence, with testimony, with a transcript.
Right, but the import of the decision from the Supreme Court and the follow-on from this court was that an administrative agency proceeding doesn't have the same preclusive effect as a court judgment.
Well, actually, the
and
focus...
That's a distinction with a difference here.
The focus was not so much on whether it was an administrative agency, but rather whether or not they appealed it to the appellate court. And they said that because they didn't appeal it to the appellate court, that they were not precluded. If they'd appealed it to the appellate court, then they would have been precluded.
Right, because then you would have had a court judgment, which is what we've got here.
Well, if Your Honor wants to adopt a rule that says that an administrative agency findings don't have any preclusive effect on any federal court action, I suppose that would be precedent, too. We would certainly be happy with
that. That's the case you just cited, and it doesn't apply here because that's not the procedural posture we're in. We've got two court judgments, one that's been affirmed on appeal.
Your Honor, the court discusses the difference between Title VII and 1983, and that's why we've cited the case, because they have explained why these causes of actions are different. Because if it was simply a question of an administrative agency versus federal, then there would have been no preclusive effect on a 1983 action. So if we accept your argument, then the court doesn't make any sense by barring a 1983 action. They barred the 1983 action, but allowed the Title VII. If all administrative agency proceedings don't have any preclusive effect, then the right decision would have been that they would have barred both, or they would have allowed both, either way. And the court didn't do that. The Supreme Court did not do it. They drew a distinction between 1983 and Title VII, and there's a reason for that, because there's a distinction here with a difference. They are different statutory schemes. They are different cases, different laws. And they are separate and apart. They're proven differently. They have different remedies. And again, if 1983, the Reconstruction-era Civil Rights Act, passed right after the Civil War, was so effective, then there would have been no reason at all for Title VII to have been passed in 1964. Title VII was passed in 64 because of a reason. There was a need for it. It covered areas that were not covered by 1983. It changed the method of proof. It changed the entire landscape. Thank you.
Ms. Masters?
May it please the Court. Peter Palka, and I'm going to be talking just about Peter and referring to him by his first name, since the county represents Tad, just to make a distinction. Peter Palka brought a Section 1983 case against the city and ADS Tobias. The city prevailed on summary judgment, but ADS Tobias did not. Peter moved to dismiss the cause without prejudice, and the district court dismissed the claims against the city that had been decided in the city's favor with prejudice and the claims against ADS Tobias without prejudice. Peter then brought his Title VII case against the city, and the court dismissed the Title VII claim as barred by res judicata. And I'm going to explain why summary judgment in the city's favor on Peter's Section 1983 case should be affirmed and why the district court subsequently found that the Title VII case was res judicata.
Do we have a final judgment problem because of the split disposition?
We do not in this case, because at this point, for a few reasons. One, the judgment is clearly final at this point, because even though the claims against ADS Tobias were dismissed without prejudice, he had 1 year to bring them under Jenkins versus Village of Maywood, and he hasn't. So those claims can't be brought again. So the judgment's clearly final, and Muzikowski from this court, states that if it can't be brought again, then it is final. The other point I would make to the court is that, although this plays into res judicata, not jurisdiction, is that Peter has always stated that this was a final judgment. So it really is final. It can't be revived. As for the Section 1983 claim, that was correctly decided in the city's favor. It was a policy claim, obviously, setting forth municipal liability. There are three bases for municipal liability: express policy that was never asserted here. The two that were asserted were that the city had a custom, policy, or practice of discrimination. the district court properly rejected that because the basis of that claim was just a statistical listing of how many people had been discharged by ADS Tobias without any context of what the race, gender breakdown was of the recruit class from which those discharges were made. So that did not establish a practice of discrimination, nor was there a proper argument that ADS Tobias was a final policymaker, because the only argument made by Peter was that ADS Tobias was a policymaker for the Academy, not that he was the final policymaker on city personnel policy. We know from Waters and other cases that we cite in our brief that in order to have a final policymaker argument, you have to show that the person you're relying upon was actually the final policymaker for the policy in question, and in this case it's city personnel policy. If the panel has no questions about that, I'm going to move on to race judicata. Obviously, there's three elements of race judicata: final judgment on the merits, same parties, and, as Judge Syke correctly pointed out, in federal court, same transaction. To begin with, as I mentioned a moment ago, Peter has never contested that there was a final judgment on the merits in the Section 1983 case, and there's cases from this court which say that if you don't contest an element, then it's waived. So there's no question that there's a final judgment in the prior case. He does, in his briefs before the court, make some type of argument that the city of Chicago was not the same defendant in Section 1983 as the city of Chicago in the Title VII case. We're going to rest on our briefs for the argument that obviously the city of Chicago is the same defendant in both places. That leaves focus on whether the Section 1983 case and the Title VII case arise from the same transaction. Now, let me make a few points about that. Counsel has talked about, and he brings up in his reply brief, this idea that the same evidence test applies. Obviously, that's a late argument. Not only is it waived, but let me be quite clear that this court in Garcia versus Village of Mount Prospect, which we cite in our race judicata brief, noted that the Illinois Supreme Court in a 1998 case called River Park versus City of Highland Park unequivocally adopted the transactional approach, which is also used by the federal courts. So the fact of the matter is that there is no distinction between what test the state courts are using and the federal courts are using. The State Court of Illinois and the federal courts both use the same transaction approach. So putting that issue aside as to what the test is, it's clear that Peter's Title VII and his race judicata claims arise from the same transaction. What we heard from counsel and what he sets forth in his brief is there's different remedies, there's different damages, there's some different facts, but it's quite solidly established by this court's precedent that that's not the issue for race judicata. What he has not disputed is that the issue in each case, did the city properly discharge Peter Palka, is the same for Section 1983 purposes and the same for Title VII. And that's what the same transaction test means. And if it is the same, then race judicata applies. Let me move on for a moment because to this idea that Mr. Palka could not have brought his Section 1983 and his Title VII claims together. Let's be quite clear that Peter actually was in possession of a right to sue letter on February 20th, and his case was dismissed at his own request on March 18th. So if he actually had a right to sue letter in his possession, there was some discussion, obviously, some questions from Judge Sykes to counsel about moving for a stay. Counsel says, well, I didn't do it. It was his obligation to try and move for a stay. That is the law of the circuit that he was supposed to be following. And having not done that, he can't come before the court and argue impossibility, say race judicata shouldn't apply because it would have been impossible for me to have gotten a stay. He didn't try, and he now cannot complain that he lacked an opportunity to litigate his Title VII claims. And the same, of course, applies for requesting a right to sue letter earlier than he did, or even delaying bringing his 1983 case because there's a two-year statute of limitations on Section 1983. He could have delayed it and then run out the clock a little bit or run down the clock a little bit and then tried to bring them together.
Help me out a little bit with the chronology here. On page 15 of your brief, I had some difficulty following it. The summary judgment in the 1983 action occurred with respect to all other claims, and then the right to sue letter was issued, and then there was a voluntary dismissal of the national origin claim against Tobias. Is that the correct chronology?
Summary judgment, the city obtained summary judgment in its favor, but ADS Tobias did not.
Right.
Then Peter requested voluntary dismissal, and he did that, I believe, in around January of 2009. He requested voluntary dismissal, and the court said in a hearing, you know, I'm not likely to do this. If you want to file a further response, please feel free. The court issued a preliminary ruling saying, on March 13th, saying, I'm not going to voluntarily dismiss without prejudice the city. The city's already prevailed. I will voluntarily dismiss ADS Tobias. You have 14 days to withdraw your motion if you don't want to go ahead with that ruling. He didn't withdraw. And then on March 18th, the district court entered its judgment. Then, in April, Peter filed his Title VII case
And the receipt of his letter
was February 20th. So it was about a month. He receives his right to sue letter February 20th. There's the order March 3rd. If you don't withdraw your motion to voluntarily dismiss, I will dismiss in 14 days.
That's where the ambiguity is. Thank you.
Okay. If the court has no further questions, the city asks that the judgment from both district courts be affirmed, and I'm going to cede the remainder of my time to the county. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Fallon?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Patricia Fallon, and I represent the Cook County defendants in this matter. For clarification as to the county's involvement versus the city's involvement, I'd like to give a very brief synopsis as to what's occurred in the county's case. This is Ted Palka's, and I believe the correct pronunciation is Ted, not Tad, Ted Palka's second federal lawsuit against the county arising from allegations related to his termination from the Sheriff's Department in 2007. The first suit, which was brought under Section 1983, was dismissed with prejudice by the district court. Mr. Palka appealed that case to this court, and the district court's dismissal was recently affirmed by this court just this past October. The second suit arises against the county with these same allegations, exact same factual situation, same core of operative facts against the same parties, but this time Mr. Ted Palka, brings suit under Title VII. As this court is well aware, the doctrine of res judicata bars not only claims that were previously decided, but also other issues that could have been raised in the prior action. Your Honors, it is the county's position that this matter has been litigated and decided. Additional claims under different theories of recovery are simply not allowed at this time under the doctrine of res judicata. Without repeating city defendants' arguments, I'm prepared to discuss the elements of res judicata. I believe all three are satisfied, and we've discussed that at some length. Unless the court has specific questions about how that relates to the county's matter, I will move on to my next point. There is no question that there has been there's a judgment on the merits in the earlier action. The parties in the two suits are identical, and as we have discussed here this morning, both suits arise from the same core of operative facts. The next point I would like to make would relate to Mr. Ted Palka's claim, that there was some legal impediment, some issue that precluded him from bringing the Title VII claim in the underlying action. I would like to be clear that it has been discussed here and that it is controlling precedent in this circuit that Mr. Palka had a responsibility to seek a stay in the district court pending the resolution of his Title VII administrative proceeding or request that the court extend the deadline for dispositive motions in his first case until he received the right to sue letter. Your Honor asked some questions regarding a timeline, and I'd like to point out a few points as they relate to the city's matter, to the county's matter, excuse me. Mr. Ted Pelka filed his first charge of discrimination with the Illinois Human Rights Department on or about September 18, 2007. The initial case that has been dismissed with prejudice, the Section 1983 case, was filed against the county on September 26, 2007. In that case, Mr. Ted Pelka, attached as support for his inability to obtain a right to sue letter the fact that he attached declarations from supervisory personnel with the EEOC, which were just procedural information regarding the EEOC's procedure, what their time frames are, nothing specific related to Mr. Ted Pelka's case, no information about him having requested a right to sue letter at the proper time, simply that 180 days would have to lapse before the EEOC would issue a right to sue letter. In terms of the chronology, I would like to point out for the court that if we are to take that statement as true, that they would wait 180 days before issuing a right to sue letter, that would bring Mr. Ted Pelka up to March of 2008. As the court now knows, the right to sue letter was not requested or received until February of 2009, and that underlying case, that Section 1983 case, was dismissed in December of 2008, which leaves 9 months remaining that he could have requested the right to sue letter or put the court on notice of that pending claim. I would also like to point out that Mr. Pelka amended his claim several times in front of the district court, the Section 1983 case, and at any of those times, three different instances when he amended his complaint, he could have put the court on notice as to the pending administrative matter and a potential 1983 claim. He did not. He chose not to do that. Finally, Your Honors, I would like to just reiterate a few points. As this court has squarely held, parties to a Title VII action enjoy no immunity from res judicata. Under Herman, Accord Garcia versus Village of Mount Prospect, and Prochowski, when a plaintiff has a potential 1983 claim and a Title VII claim, he must await a right to sue letter before moving ahead on his Title VII claim. He has several options in order to avoid claim splitting, which is prohibited. Number one, he can seek the right to sue letter from the EEOC. Number two, he can delay filing the 1983 lawsuit, which we know has a 2-year statute of limitations. Or number three, he can request that the court postpone or stay the first suit. He chose to do none of these things. It is the county's position that this matter is prohibited under the doctrine of res judicata, and unless there are any further questions for me regarding the county's case, we would respectfully request that the court affirm the judgment of the district court with respect to the county defendants. Thank you.
Counsel. Glenn, how much time does Mr. Platt have?
With all due respect, counsel has just misstated the record. If you look at our response to the summary judgment motion, you will see that there were three declarations attached to the summary judgment motion. There were two from the EEOC. One was from the district deputy director, which is the number two person in the entire office, and then the person in charge of state-federal relations. And then there was a declaration from Peter Pelka, and in Peter Pelka's declaration, and I implore the court to please look at this because it's there, Mr. Peter Pelka says that we requested the right to sue letter not once but several times and that the request was denied. So it's not a question of us sitting on our rights and not doing anything in terms of requesting the right to sue letter. We're not requesting it for 2 years. We requested it at or about the time we filed the 1983 case, and that request was denied. And the reason it was denied, as explained by the declarations, is that when a case is on a cross-file situation and it is being investigated by the state agency, the EEOC does not issue a right to sue letter. So it was an impossibility. Second of all, as the court discovered in argument, the right to sue letters that were received in February and March, after summary judgment was granted on the 1983 claim. And again, that was a long time after the request for the right to sue letters had first been made, which had been made while the 1983 case was pending and, in fact, even before it was filed. So this is not a question of where people sat on their rights. It's a question of where they made the request and attempted to put it together into one lawsuit and were prohibited from doing so by the agency. Unless there's further questions, I have nothing further to add.
Thank you, Mr. Platt.
Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.